Hello, and welcome to episode 220 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
About 10 years ago, I was working at a local newspaper on a special section featuring high school graduates. I had more space in that section than I did graduates, so I started looking for related content to fill the last page. I found a syndicated column by Dick Meyer, and all these years later, what he wrote has stuck with me. His column took aim at one of America's favorite bits of advice: follow your dream. Meyer argued that this mantra, while inspiring, is often misleading, because not everyone's dream can or should become a career. Pretending otherwise, he wrote, leaves people feeling like failures when ordinary success should be enough. Rick, I thought this was a refreshing bit of honesty, but do you think Meyer's being too cynical, or do you think he's calling out a cultural lie we've been telling ourselves for far too long?
I think Meyer's exactly right. I think it can be really damaging to tell all kids over and over to follow their dream. It's not that there's anything wrong with having a dream or with following it. It's just that, like a lot of young people, even a lot of adults, that don't really have anything that they feel that passionate about. The other thing is, like, just feeling passionate about something, say when you're 18, doesn't mean that it's worth pursuing. And this is one of the things he points out, like, you can have a lot of trivial passions at different times, and they're not really. I think it's a much better advice to say, find something that's important, find something that's worthy of your life to invest in, and work at becoming good at it.
It's funny. I had, I think, like, two teenage era dreams of what I wanted to do. One was something around baseball, and I knew I was never, ever, ever, ever going to be a professional baseball player. I wasn't even a good, like, high school baseball player. So, I mean, that was never in the cards. But, like, I thought, gosh, it would be fun to be a baseball announcer one day. But, like, I was also smart enough to know that there's, like, only 30 of those jobs, or I guess if you do TV and radio, maybe a few more. But, like, I, for some reason, I thought that was, like, unattainable. And you know, I guess I can talk about baseball on here. So I attained about 2% of that. The other dream I had, which also, though, seemed ridiculously unobtainable, which it wasn't, probably, I wanted to be a TV meteorologist.
Hmm.
And I also got to live that dream one day.
Yeah, yeah. Did you go to station and talk to the person who was a meteorologist?
Well, yeah, it was a friend of mine was a news director at a local TV station, and I told him the same story I just told you about wanting to do that one day. And they had, I use the term very loosely, but one week they had celebrity weathercasters come in, and these were just people from the community who had different jobs. And I was in there one day, and I got to do like a 3-minute weather forecast all by myself, where I stood in front of the maps and pointed and gestured and talked about cold fronts and all that stuff. So I got to live my dream once. Looking back, if that was, like, as a kid, if that was something I wanted to pursue more than anything else, I mean, I probably could have done that, right? But I don't remember my parents, and I was mostly raised in those years. My mother was sort of the primary caregiver. I don't remember ever her saying, follow your dreams, but she also said something that I do remember that's related, and I think parents often say, is you can do whatever you set your mind to. And that's, you know, I remember thinking at the time, like, well, I don't know what I want to do. That's not helpful, really. So I don't know. That's just sort of like my look back at all this, but I just worry that, like you, that these passions that we're told to follow, whether we're 15, 25, or 55, can be kind of fickle.
They're incredibly fickle. And I run into college students all the time that are really pushed to declare a major before they even get into college. They're supposed to declare something. They follow that path for a while, and then they find out, say, they're going into health sciences and find out, like, they faint at the sight of blood, right? Like, realize that's not going to work out. Or they just realize that their outside view of this profession wasn't what they thought. I think things like job shadowing programs and so forth, I think they're incredibly useful. But I don't think we should be encouraging young people to pick something too quickly. I think it's much more important to develop a broad set of skills and then to get some acquaintance with the range of things that can be done. One of the things I found is that with the right kind of attitude, it is possible to become passionate about all kinds of things. And so don't just say follow your passion or follow your dream, because like what you happen to be passionate about is limited to those few things you happen to already be familiar with. You can get familiar with a lot more things in the world.
And you said, I think, and please correct me here, is that instead of thinking about following your passion, you should find something that you think you can contribute to society. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Is it how also, though, should you, as people are thinking about those things, should also you be thinking about, like, what does society need right now? Is that, should that be something that should be part of that discussion that may be more important than what fickle dream you might have at the moment?
I think so. Because we get, when we are useful to other people, we develop a real sense of pride in what we're doing. We find satisfaction in that. Now, there are some sorts of things that we know would be useful, but we just would have a real distaste for doing. So, like, yeah, you can rule some of those things out, but don't fix on a particular path too quickly, because anything that provides lasting meaning for us in our lives is going to be something that we feel to be really useful, that contributes some way to people's lives in a positive sense. And so it takes a while to figure out what those things are.
There are a lot of things in this world I'm not an expert at, and I'm about to talk about one of those things, but I'm going to try to explain it in a way that I think is probably accurate, and I don't know if there's anything you know anything about. But I remember having a conversation a few years ago with someone who was an expert about the German education system. And as I recollect our conversation, is that the education system there, which is can be fairly rigorous, also is fairly quick at identifying what students' skills are and saying, you know, you're and this group of students really seems to have the potential to go on to higher education, maybe has skills around the sciences or around technology or around the arts, and really early identifies these people who, young people, who have these abilities and sort of tailors their education much earlier, I think, than we do here in America to get them to these places. And I think that's fine in some ways. But like, what if you're 24 and you've gone through all that and you realize that, you know, I don't want to be in healthcare, or I don't want to be elementary educator, or I don't want to be an electrician? Like, how do you change? How do you like unwind that? And well, it's not easy, I guess. And I don't know if you know anything about this German system, but like, I think it's like inherently flawed because it is giving young people like way too much credit for like knowing what they're good at or having the chance to discover things that they might not even know they're good at.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there are some advantages to it, but the disadvantage is precisely what you point out, that we're not really mature enough to know like enough about the world to know what we're going to be good at. And our skills and our interests all develop kind of slowly, especially at those ages, and especially for boys, like the mental capacity and the ability to pay attention and so forth develops a little bit later than for girls. And so if you do that too quickly, you run the danger of people like being excluded from options that might otherwise be open to them. I remember there's quite a few of the European countries that have a system like that, where they direct you down a certain path fairly early on, say like 13, 14, or sometimes as late as 16, but usually by then. I went to college for a year and in England at the University of Lancaster, and the person who was in my dorm right across the hall from me was quite a few years older, and he had been directed down one of these other paths and then came back and decided he really wanted to go to university, but it took him a long time to catch up, to study all kinds of things and take exams so he could get entrance into the university. And so he was about, I think he was 6 or 7 years older than I was, just starting at the university.
You know, speaking of universities, you spend a lot of time in one. And I'm sure not all, but the majority of the students you deal with and teach are, you know, 18 to 24, we'll say. And in that age group, we continue to hear that, and we talked about this in countless episodes, about how young people today seem to have higher levels of stress, higher levels of anxiety, higher levels of feeling like they fit somewhere in the world. And I just can't help but think, I mean, this is not like some simple one answer for everything, but I think part of the reasons they feel that in some ways is maybe because they really do feel like they have to find this one great thing that they're passionate about. And if they haven't found it yet, well, maybe there's something wrong with them, or they just need to pay more attention or get new skills. And if they find themselves in a career that's like dependable and stable and pays fine and they're happy with, but it's nothing they're passionate about, do they feel like failures? I mean, do you get the sense that this is sort of adding to an already anxiety-laden group of people?
Yes, I think it does. I've talked to some students who clearly felt that way. And I remember classmates when I was in college, and it was easier when I was in college talking with classmates my own age, of having them like confess really candidly what their anxieties were, than like now I'm a professor, there's a kind of distance.
Yeah,
they're going to talk to their roommates about it, but not to me. But we find it's a pretty common phenomenon. And I remember having a good friend who was just saying, like, I have no idea what I want to major in, what I want to do with my life. And it's getting, you know, it's getting towards, you know, like his junior year. And he was thinking, like, everybody else had picked a major. Well, like, a lot of them had picked majors that they were not going to keep working in. This is the real truth is, like, even in professions where it seems like people have a real dedication or purpose going into, like in education and nursing, it's a really high burnout rate or in the first 5 years. And so a large percentage of young people going into these professions that are really all-encompassing when they're in college, they end up shifting to something completely different because they find out it just doesn't work.
Well, and the jobs we have shift so much, right?
Yeah.
Like, I don't think you were a junior in high school in Frazee, Minnesota, thinking to yourself, you know, if I work real hard and study and do all the things I'm supposed to do, I may one day host a podcast. That's probably not something that came to mind when you were in Frazee.
No, I at that time, I thought I was going to be a chemist working in a laboratory somewhere then.
And that's not what you did.
No.
Was that something you were truly passionate about, though, like test tubes and elements and chemicals and all that stuff I don't understand?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say passionate about, but I thought I really liked it. I was intrigued by it, and I just didn't have much experience of other things. And so I thought, yeah, that sounds like it'd be really cool. And then I, my mother worked at a hospital, and so I got to spend a day job shadowing some people who worked in the lab there and realize, oh, this doesn't seem very interesting at all. I mean, that's like just our vision of what is possible in life is so constricted when we are, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old. I don't think we should be making life choices based on that. I really wish we would have less pressure on students to declare a major or to announce like what their dream or what their passion is, and just say, like, I need to just develop some general skills and figure out ways in which I can be useful, and then be happy at whatever life presents. And this is something, when I went into graduate school, I went into a PhD program in philosophy knowing that the job prospects were really bad. And I had to figure out for myself, well, what are my expectations going into this? And what I eventually said is, well, I may not be able to get a job in it, but there are things that I really want to learn that I think are going to be good for me to know for the rest of my life. But I may end up painting houses like my dad did, and that would be okay. I just don't know what life has in store. I want to do something that's useful. But in the meantime, there's some things I want to learn first.
So I've started the show just 15 minutes ago, agreeing with you, actually, that, and agreeing with the Dick Meyer column, which I should point out we'll link to, I've actually have a bit of a different opinion now, and I'll tell you why. And maybe this is going to sound a little corny, so I'll warn you of that. But I think when you were a kid, and certainly when your father was a kid, it might be have been easier then to like find something you're passionate about. Let's say you like, you know, there's, you really like cars and you wanted to be a mechanic, and like that's something you can do and you can make a decent a career out of, and you're fine. But today, I think the one thing we know, and it's already happening and there's no conceivable way it will stop, is that the job market's changing so much. I mean, just about 5-6 years ago, the sort of cliche was, oh, just teach your kids to code. That's all you need to do is teach your kids to code, and they can just write their ticket. Well, guess what? Now with AI, coding has become, in many cases, not nearly as important. And we didn't know that, right? And I don't think we know what the big jobs are going to be 10, 15, 20 years from now. So I think why I've changed my mind is that ideally what you should be passionate about is learning, right? Is that if you're passionate about being curious and learning new things and jumping at new opportunities, if that's your passion, I mean, that is probably a way you almost can punch your ticket, right?
Yes, and I have been in a position now where I've hired a lot of people over the course of my career. I've been on a lot of job searches. Whenever we've hired somebody who's passionate about learning, they've been a good hire because they've figured out not just how to do the job that we hire them for, but sometimes other jobs, and they move into other things. They're able to move laterally or move up within the organization. The mistakes have always been somebody had a really narrow focus and had a skill set, but were just set on that. And then the job changes,
yeah,
you know, because environment changes and they're not really interested in learning. They're not passionate about that, and they can't change, and they become obsolete. And this happens quite often. And so I think you're exactly right. If you're passionate about learning, you're always going to find a place in society because you can always pick up new skills, new abilities, new bits of knowledge that you can employ in places that are needed.
But so if that's true, and I think we both think it probably is, but going back to my car mechanic story, I mean, if you have the skills, if you're a car mechanic, you can teach those skills to somebody else. I mean, those are transferable skills. If you're a welder, those are transferable skills. If somebody wants to become a welder, they probably can. But is this passion for learning, passion for change, passion for adaptability, is that something that is a transferable skill? Can you teach that? Or is that something that is more of like a personality trait?
Well, it is what's come to be known to the psychologist Carol Dweck coined these two phrases, a growth mindset and a fixed mindset. And what she has found in all kinds of research is people who have a fixed mindset, thinking that like they have like certain abilities, certain talents, certain sets of skills, and that's it. They end up not being very adaptable, and life ends up being pretty frustrating for them. And so what you want to encourage in kids is a growth mindset that is looking at obstacles as opportunities to overcome them. And so this idea of having a positive attitude towards adaptability, for example, all of these things go into the growth mindset. And it seems to be kind of a personality trait that some kids just seem to have from a very early age. Some have a more of a tendency towards a fixed mindset, but just about anybody can adopt a growth mindset. It's not something that's a fixed personality trait. It's a malleable one. And so I think it is something we can encourage in ourselves, but it's also really important in our society to encourage it in children. And it becomes more important when we have an economy that keeps changing unpredictably about every 4 or 5 years.
Do you think, though, the way, whether it's grade school or, you know, universities in this country, do you think we're doing a good job with that? I mean, I think, you know, and because it's tough to, I mean, we have, you know, I'm not going to get to an argument about standardized tests, but I mean, we have tests that we think we can measure math and reading skills, and maybe it measures them well and maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But like, I don't think there's a way to measure this, or is there? And how do we know as a society if this is something that we're encouraging in the education process?
Yeah, we know there are ways to teach it and ways to measure it. We're not doing a very good job of it.
But how do we teach it?
For one thing, you respond when kids say, like, they'll say something like, I'm just not very good at that. And you say, well, like, nobody is just born good at it or not good at it. It's something that you learn. And so let's help you figure out. Or when they say things like they have a failure of some kind, and they complain, why does this always happen to me? And you just try to gently point out, well, this happens to everybody. It's not just happening to you. Like there's patterns of this kind of pessimistic thinking that when allowed to go on, they become habitual in the mind. And so what you want to do is not allow them to become habitual by keep reminding kids that it's possible to change, it's possible to adapt, it's possible to overcome obstacles, that they're not permanent roadblocks to getting where you want to go.
And if that's how you try to instill that in young people, how do you measure it?
Well, you just measure it with you can do simple surveys.
Okay.
Where you present them with different kinds of obstacles or stumbling blocks and see how they respond to it. Like when Carol Dweck proposed this theory, and it became really popular among educators. So most students now who are studying education, preparing to be teachers, learn all about this idea of fixed mindsets and growth mindsets. But instead of kind of adopting really creative ways of helping to instill it, what they end up doing is taking the theory and teaching it to little kids. And kids don't need the theory about fixed and growth mindsets. So I was talking to a parent recently who's something happened and they were really upset and said, oh, this is so frustrating. I can never get this to work. And the daughter says, Dad, that's a fixed mindset. But she was in kindergarten and her teachers were telling them about the theory of fixed and growth mindset, which I don't think that's necessarily bad. But what they really need is they just need encouragement at the appropriate time, not to learn a theory.
I feel like I got us off on a bit of a tangent there. So I just want to kind of bring us back more as we close on this topic to how we define like what our lives are and what they're about. And whether this dream aspect is really something that we should spend as much time focusing on. And it reminded me of a conversation I had with a journalist friend of mine. And she and I met with my husband over coffee a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, and obviously whenever you're in a situation like that with you and a colleague, and then, you know, a third person's along, you'd have to try to avoid just not talking shop the whole time, right? And I'm sure she was aware of that. So after a couple minutes of just pleasantries, she turns to him and says, "So what's your story?" And I think for a second caught him off guard, because that's not a question most people ask. Most people, kind of the default question is, "What do you do?" And she's a journalist, and she's a good journalist, so I'm sure she is used to and hoping to get better responses from people, and that's probably a tactic I bet she uses a lot. But that is a good question to ask, right? Because it lets the person sort of take that discussion in whatever way they want to take that discussion.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's a great idea. And it reminded me of talking with this young woman who had been spent several months, I think it was in Cameroon, it was in an African country, and her kind of surprise and delight that wherever she traveled and she would meet people, they wouldn't ask her what she did. They would try to figure out who she knows, because they define themselves by their relationships, by, you know, what was their family relationships and their friend relationships, and they wanted to know if their relationships overlapped anywhere, right? And this is a very different way of looking at a person's identity, instead of saying that, like, I know who you are if I know what job you hold. I know who you are if I know where you fit into the society, right? And so I think that's really refreshing. And also, like, I've known a lot of people over the years that for a while have been between jobs.
Yeah.
That is really hard, because you really lose a sense of who you are. And in our culture in particular, like, if you don't have a job for a while, and I think this happens with people who retire, they really feel a loss of identity. And I think it's because it's a mistake to wrap up too much of our identity in our job, especially our job titles.
So then, getting back to this premise from the Dick Meyer column that started our conversation, following your dreams professionally is often unrealistic, or often leads to situations that may find you unhappy in the future, because your dreams may change. But finding things that interest me, like, if you have an interest in woodworking, and, like, I guess maybe woodworking is not the best example because there's some cost outlay there. But, like, after 5 or 10 years, you're sort of like, you know, I don't want to turn a table leg anymore. I'm sort of done with this. Well, that's fine, right? As long as it's replaced by something else. I mean, I know a family member who, it's interesting, actually. I have a family member who is always really passionate about a project. And it can take, like, a year, sometimes 2 years to do this project. And you can tell it is, like, one of the most important things, and these aren't work-related things, one of the most important things in his life. And you know what happens when the project's done? You might think, oh gosh, he's built this, or he's created something. He's just going to spend all the time using it. Nope.
No, he's got to find another project.
Exactly.
Because there's a real disappointment when you finish the project, because the meaning is in the doing it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a secret that a lot of people don't discover, right? That, like, we need meaningful activities to guide us. More importantly than that, though, we need good friendships. We have all this evidence now, like, the thing that makes us happiest in life is having a few really quality friends. And so I wish that instead of asking people, what is your dream or what is your passion, we'd say, like, go out and invest in friendship. Make some more friends. That would be really good life advice for young people.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, What is your question this week for me?
Okay, Scott, I've got something for you to tackle.
My pads are on, my helmet's ready, and I'm, what do football players do? They're lined up and ready to go.
Right.
I don't know much about football.
Waiting for the snap.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the snap.
So here's the snap. A recent Wall Street Journal article reported that the CEOs of several high-profile companies are sick and tired of employees checking messages on their phones during meetings, even though some admit it's a practice they themselves do when they're bored or when they know what the speaker is going to say at a meeting. I'm just wondering about you, Scott. How do you feel about that? When you are in meetings with people, do you feel free to check your phone during the meeting if like you already know what is being said and it's not really engaging? Or do you, out of respect or something, you just put your phone away and not check it until after the meeting's over?
So a couple of things. First of all, with rare exceptions, and there are occasional rare exceptions, but 95% of my meetings I have are remote. So it's a little bit easier to do that at times when you're working remotely. So, and I will also say, and this happens a couple of times a week, where I may be like part of a training call or maybe on a call that I help put together the training deck. And I'm just there to maybe answer a question or two, but like I know exactly what this is going to be and what's gonna. I mean, if the person their connection dropped, I could probably present if I needed to. So in those cases, I'm not hanging on every word, for those reasons. So there are times like that, but I think you're talking more about people who are more the receiving end of these work presentations. And I guess two things I would say. One, if you're consistently, and it's probably easier to talk about this if they're in person, but if you're consistently giving presentations and you consistently see people on their phones not paying attention, you have to take some ownership of that, I think, because you're clearly either not presenting in a way that's capturing their attention or the content that you're sharing is not especially interesting or useful in their jobs. Secondly, though, I think there's also a difference if you're responding to like an urgent request from another colleague who has a question that you really know you replying now will help them move on to the next thing versus like writing some pithy response to somebody's Facebook post that's obviously not work related. So those are sort of different categories to me. And I don't know, I'll confess, I know you linked to a Wall Street Journal article that talked about this. I didn't read it. I should have. But did it
you didn't need to read it.
But did it differentiate between like responding to personal versus work-related messages, or no? They're just upset about people not paying attention to what they're saying?
Yeah, and it was really about a trend that's happening where more companies are implementing policies now, like you can't check phones or iPads or things during a meeting. And I think they just meant in-person meetings.
Yeah. And I mean, I think there are few companies out there. Well, it's weird. Okay, so it's weird, and I think you would agree with this position, that two things are probably true. Most workers feel like they are invited to too many meetings.
Yep.
And most workers don't feel like they have all the information they need to do their job.
Yeah.
And like those seem like, it would seem like, well, then you should attend more meetings. But that probably isn't true. It just seems like the way either A, the information that's important is not the information that's being talked about, or it could, or we've all been to meetings that you sort of sit back and say, well, that could have been a 3-paragraph email and not a meeting. So, but it is like there is certainly that split there where people want to know more but find meetings useless. That's a problem.
Yes, it is a problem. And so one of the lessons here is, like, let's make sure, first of all, before we implement policies like that, let's make sure that the meetings are really, they're important,
mm-hmm.
And that they're filled with, like, content, that they're not wasting people's times. I since reading this piece, like, a little over a week ago, I've been thinking about, like, how often do I take my phone out at meetings? And I realize it's generally when I know that there might be some messages or things coming in that I might have to give a quick response to or at least know about. But as a person who's also a kind of on the receiving end, who's often running meetings or a presenter, it is really disturbing when somebody, say, flips open a laptop and they're just engaged in the laptop during the whole time. Even if they're taking, you don't know what.
Yeah, you don't. Like, yeah.
What are they there for? Now, sometimes I've been that person with my laptop open because I've had to, like, the only way to actually go to the meeting was also to respond to some other messages coming in that are coming in during that time. This is one of just the complexities of life right now, I think, is that with constant access to us, and there's an expectation that we're going to respond right away to certain kinds of things. And so multitasking becomes part of how we do our jobs, right?
And I think, and I mean, you know, different jobs require different, I mean, have different workplaces, have different, you know, number, you know, is this a meeting of seven people or 700 people? But I think some of the better meetings that you can have are ones that are 15 minutes or shorter, and maybe 15 people or fewer, and you're all standing up. Like, I know that happens, like, in retail stores a lot, I think, that where, like, before the 9 a.m. time when the doors open, you know, the manager will, you know, ask all the employees to come to the front at 8:45, and they'll be gathered up there and, like, you know, here's what we're really trying to sell today, or here's our sales goal, or, you know, here's some new product we got in, or here's, you know, and kind of go over 5 or 6 points. And I just think when people are standing up and you know, the clock literally is ticking, because at 9 o'clock you have to go over and unlock the door and let folks in the building. Like, those, I think, in some ways are probably some of the most effective ones, because you're on a timer in a way and you're standing up. And I think when you're standing up, you feel like you're more attentive, and you're also less likely to be fiddling around on some device. So I don't know. Part of me thinks that shorter meetings that force you to stand is probably, like, good.
I can't recall too many meetings that last over an hour where I thought they were really good uses of time. And there are some kinds of meetings where you need an hour to cover the business that you're going to cover.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're generally right. Shorter is better. And you keep people's attention focused. And so there's high levels of engagement during the time that you're in the meeting. And if people need to check on a message, well, they can wait for 15 minutes.
Yeah. Right? Well, and, you know, we know that people's, especially young people's, but I think almost all people's attention spans are getting shorter. I mean, why do people watch TikTok? You know, why do people watch 100 TikTok videos that are maybe a minute a piece more often than watching a feature film that might be 100 minutes? Because we have short attention spans, or because we don't want to, even though the timing, the actual time spent can be similar, I think we just consume information so much differently. So, like, I think if you have an hour's worth of information that's not critical to that day, doing 4 or 5, 10 or 15 minute meetings over the course of a week is probably not a bad idea.
And it depends on the kind of work you're trying to get done.
Yeah, that's true, meeting. Certainly.
Yeah. So the most efficient meetings that I've been a part of have been in healthcare settings. And I've served on a couple of different committees where I was kind of the community person, say on an ethics committee or an internal review board committee. They were They were always an hour, but they were, the agenda was jam-packed, so you were pushing through really quickly and making some really important decisions. But then, but you'd start right on time and end. Like if it was a 55-minute meeting, it would end at 55 minutes. And if you didn't get everything done, you'd move it back to the next time. When I'm at a university, I find that like we're terrible about having lazy meetings, late starts, running over time, and then not really filling that hour. And I think a lot of times we'd be better off with your advice. Let's do a stand-up 15-minute meeting and we'd get more done and have more focus.
I want to just take that in one other direction is that, and this might be more common with remote workers, but maybe it's not. But you certainly talk a lot about the value of personal connection and building relationships and all that stuff. And some companies at least say they believe that to be important. And in fact, some companies, if they're going to have a half hour meeting, the first 10 minutes might be these icebreakers like, oh, let's everybody go around the room and say how you spent your weekend or what you have planned for Thanksgiving or, you know, whatever it might be. I know someone who is in regularly part of work meetings that do those sort of things. And this particular person just wants to like, can we just please get to the point of this and move on? But as someone who values those relationship building things, is that so? I guess I'm not sure. I'll be curious to hear where you fall on those type of activities.
I generally dislike them because they're so poorly done.
Okay.
And they're artificial. You don't end up talking about things that are really meaningful, and they feel like a waste of time. I think some of the deepest relationships that we develop at work are when people are engaged in meaningful projects together. And so I would say that that's one way of building relationships. Have people work on something that's really important together. They're going to build a relationship, and that's much more effective than icebreakers often.
So do you ever, but you do some of those with your classes a little bit, right?
Yeah, I do different kinds of things. One of the things I've noticed is when we get right in ethics classes, I really need to focus for a few weeks on building relationships. And so I have really highly interactive kinds of classes, especially the first few weeks, so that they get to know one another. But it's not like so many people don't like icebreakers because they're so superficial or kind of hokey. But you can get people engaged in meaningful conversation, and people tend to like that. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, so it really kind of comes back to where we started. This is that the responsibility really falls on the meeting organizer to A, make sure, well, really, I guess, you know, maybe I'll say A, B, and C, but no, it's really just one thing. Make sure that time is well spent.
Yeah, yeah.
And it sounds easy to say, and I'm sure, but it's important.
It takes preparation.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you have to really plan it.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and you would be foolish to not check out Rick's column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thanks for listening.